and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare, and science in the news, answers to your emails and your phone calls, all coming up right here. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So that being said, a couple of updates to the website I want to tell you about at AskDrDawn.com. We have the Google flu trends. Of course, Google's there with a state-level inflow on the number of flu cases, and I'll be there with an update on that in just a minute. I also wanted to tell you about the pollution scorecard. This is a website called scorecard.org that give you very detailed local pollution data based on your zip code. You can find out where your local Superfund sites are. You can find out where the contaminated wells are, where the former factories are, what the average level of pollution is in an area. Might be useful if you're thinking of moving to an area. Certainly useful if you already live there. Find out where and what the pitfalls are and what you need to be careful about. So that would work for anyone in the continental United States. Don't think it goes outside of the U.S. Really interesting information, though. Before we go into the flu, this is a very important alert that came out of the FDA this week. And grandma and grandpa, especially grandpa, take note of this. There have been a number of fairly serious complications arising in children who have been exposed inadvertently to testosterone gels. And this isn't a case of the kids getting their hands on the medication. This is a case of men, or in fact women, prescribed the medication, who got their hands on the kids and inadvertently transferred the testosterone gel. Now, the complications that have been seen are inappropriate enlargement of the penis or clitoris, premature development of pubic hair, and this one's really got me worried, advanced bone age. There have been at least 8 cases of these complications. And in the cases reviewed, the average duration of exposure was about 6 months to a year. And over that time, the child absorbed enough testosterone to have fairly profound physiological changes. Now, advanced bone age is a real bad one because that could keep you from reaching your genetically predetermined height. In other words, that testosterone gel will stunt your growth if you're a child. We have to be really careful about this because people put the gels on to replace testosterone when they develop hypogonadism. Some women are using it off-label for libido enhancement. Typically, it's put on the upper body, the arms usually. And, you know, if you hug your grandchild and you're sweaty, or if it hasn't dried, there's a potential of transferring it. And certainly being careful to wash your hands after applying the gel is critical. But maybe putting it over the part of the body that's always going to be covered by clothes would be an additional precaution. Anyway, I wanted to put that out there because I know there's a lot of people using these gels. And if you're also around an infant or a young child, basically anybody who's still growing, you need to be very, very careful not to inadvertently dose them with the stuff. Let's take a moment and talk about the flu. A little update. Last week was a week where we had talked about the flu in hopefully some rational and not hysterical way. There have been 1,700 confirmed cases as of yesterday. The flu is much less virulent than the original version that was seen. Virulent is how sick it makes you. And it's about a standard flu, which is good. The important thing here, I think, is not to feel like this was a false alarm. It wasn't a false alarm. We got lucky. The alarm was completely appropriate. And a similar alarm, every time there is a major antigenic shift, is appropriate. I think the Mexican authorities did really well by closing things down when they did. You could argue they might have done it sooner, but at least they did it. And by doing it, I think they limited the exposure to, and as we talked about last week, the kinder, gentler virus that could travel did, and obviously is now infecting us. But we got lucky also because it's spring, and flu virus transmits much better in the winter. flu particles have to remain in the air, and the wetter the air is, the less time they remain in the air. That's a good thing. And indeed, the flu virus will come back, and the swine flu will come back in the fall. And at that point, we all need to get our flu vaccinations. The vaccine people really need to get to work and grow the stuff so that there is enough. We need to vaccinate the young and the old for preference if there's a shortage. But it's definitely a good year to get a flu shot. And I hope people will understand that this will be back. And it's a little Darwinian microcosm. It will keep mutating. If it becomes more aggressive, we could be in trouble because we don't have the herd immunity yet. At this point, you should still be washing your hands frequently. You should still be staying home if you're sick. You know, it's hard. We've got a huge backlog here in our county and in Santa Clara County, a huge backlog of tests waiting to be run to confirm whether there's H1N1 flu here. How do you know if you got the flu anyway? I mean, it's, how do you tell the difference between the flu and a cold? And it is difficult. This advice from Lori Garrett, who wrote a very well-known book called The Coming Plague, Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. It's one of the Bibles of this. Anyway, she says, use the sledgehammer test. The flu comes on like a sledgehammer. If you feel vaguely off, and then, you know, within 12 hours, you feel like somebody whacked you over the head, you've got a bad headache, bad body aches, and a fever, that's probably flu. If it kind of comes on gradually, we all sort of know about the rhythm of a respiratory illness. You get the sore throat, then the next day your nose stuffs up and you start to sneeze, and then the next day you start with the cough. If it's that kind of speed, it's probably not the flu. And that's kind of the triage I've been doing in my office. It's like, how long did it take you to get sick, and how badly do you feel compared to the usual cold? And essentially, if you feel like you got a cold, you probably have a cold. Stay home. If you have a fever and you've got body aches and you've got a bad headache and it came on fast, well, you might have the flu. And at that point, you should call your doctor and find out if your doctor has the tests and can do them in the office or wants to redirect you elsewhere. My producer just gave us a scary statistic in a poll, in a Mexican poll last week. 25% of Mexicans think the flu was actually a hoax by their government, because 99.8% of the people who were polled don't know anyone who has the flu. Now, that's good. They should be happy that they don't know anyone who has the flu. But it's interesting that people conclude it was a hoax. It wasn't a hoax. It did seem to be on everybody's lips there for a couple of days. That's a good thing. I was very impressed with the way the system worked. I think it was a good test of the early warning system. And if you're at the epicenter of the flu, they should shut down your schools. That you should shut down and wait a couple of days and see what's happening, particularly if it's an antigenic shift. You've got to give it a chance to damp out and let those people who've got the initial infection, you've got to see how bad it is. Fortunately, once it hits, it moves fast. So 48 hours of school closure is enough to tell you what you're dealing with and enough to get some tests back. Let's go to the first of our callers. It's Vince in Capitola. Hello, Vince, and welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi. Your talk earlier this morning about testosterone made me think that I wanted to put forth, I receive testosterone shots because I have hypogonadism.
Uh-huh.
And I've tried some of those gels in the past, and I had a lot of trouble with them myself, but I've just been using the shots, and I'm wondering if, well, I also have very high level of osteoporosis, like extremely high, and they think that maybe that there could be some connection. I'm only 59, so like a negative 4.2, if that.
Right. That's very bad osteoposis.
I know. They want to, there's some talk that they would like me to start one of those drugs, and I haven't yet.
One of what drugs?
The ones like Fosamax.
Fosamax, or, oh yeah.
Something in that family.
Two questions for you. Family history of fractures?
No.
And have you drank her any time in your life?
Yeah, but probably over 20 years ago now.
Yeah, but you might have pulled the calcium out of your bones while you were a heavy drinker. The other thought is parathyroid gland. I presume they've checked your parathyroid levels and your vitamin D?
Yes. But, those came out good. I think it was running around 49 mm-hmm. for the one that you talk about.
Good. For the audience, if a person develops osteoporosis unexpectedly, and in a male it would be somewhat unexpected, you look for a tumor of the parathyroid. This type of tumor is not a cancer per se. It's an overactive gland, and it can cause a lot of calcium loss from bones. So do you have a question about the bisphosphonates?
Well, I had a question initially when I was doing the testosterone shots. It seemed like I was going up and down, and now I've gotten... It seems like it's more even, but that was one of the reasons they talked about wanting to have me put it on my skin as well as having an injection. And mm-hmm. I'm actually more comfortable with the injection because of some of the reasons you mentioned.
Right. Well, the skin saturates after about 2 weeks, and then the fat under your skin sort of acts like a depot.
Gotcha.
And so it smooths out the bumps that you're going to get when you inject something. No matter how hard you try, the initial few days after the injection, you're going to get a real surge of levels.
Mm-hmm.
Whether to do that rather depends upon your exposure to children. If someone else were in your situation, it sounds like you've stabilized, so you don't necessarily need to worry. But when it's proposed, if you do need to use the gels, obviously it needs to be on a part of your body that's not going to come into the contact with the kids. Your back is probably a pretty good spot, as long as you don't carry the kids around piggyback, you know, right. In contact with your bare skin.
Right.
And I think in general, as long as people are prudent and cautious and remember to wash their hands, this is, you know, not too big a problem. It's grandpa and grandma, particularly grandpa, who's going to be at risk for exposing the grandkids. And obviously, you're supposed to wash your hands before you touch an infant anyway. So this is one more good reason to do that.
Is there any risk for long-term usage of it? I mean, how do they... You know, I had one initial test, so my levels of testosterone, they do two different kinds, were up in a zone that he liked.
You can think of this as effectively a hormone replacement.
Mm-hmm.
So your testes cut out early and aren't producing something that should be there, and we're just putting it back the way it's supposed to be. So in terms of long-term side effects, it's the long-term side effects of being alive and having testes would be the same as being alive and using testosterone. So not really. You know, your risk of prostate cancer is higher if you have testosterone in your body.
Exactly. You know,
If you remove the testicles, it helps prostate cancer. It's a little bit radical, but your prostate cancer risk does drop if your testes are removed.
True.
We don't consider it an appropriate preventative strategy.
As far as the osteoporosis that I have.
I would say with a -4, you might even want to consider Forteo rather than a bisphosphonate. Build some bone back up.
Forteo.
Forteo is a calcitonin analog. So calcitonin is the hormone that puts calcium into bones.
Mm-hmm.
It's the yin-yang, okay? Parathyroid takes it out, calcitonin puts it in. We often have a sort of yin-yang thing going on with hormones.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's going on with that one. And if you take an artificial form of calcitonin, it's taken by injection. And aside from the fact that it can raise calcium levels in the bloodstream, so that needs to be monitored, it's a very good way to build back bone mass. Might be a more appropriate strategy for you. It's expensive, and your doctor will have to work fairly hard to get it covered by your health insurance. If you don't have health insurance, forget it. Well, maybe actually you could get the company to give it to you if you threw yourself on the mercy of the court, so to speak.
I think originally, I'm seeing a rheumatologist and also a specialist in this realm too, but I went to a rheumatologist because I have a pre-existing rheumatoid condition, and he did a lot of the tests. And, you know, he talked about some of the older ones, not the Forteo, because the generics are, you know, more readily covered.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly, and that's... There's a huge hassle factor in getting an expensive drug for a patient who needs it. But I think from a rational standpoint, it would be better to put bone back in and actually build you up if you're at -4.0. I think you're at significant risk of a pathological fracture. I would try to reverse that and get you maybe to a -2.
Right.
And then stop the Forteo and stabilize it with some bisphosphonate. Another thing that should be done at this point is you can get a urine test, pyridinium crosslinks. These are basically bone breakdown products that if you're losing bone, it'll be high in your urine.
Well, you know, I did have that, and I think it came out fine. I had that
fairly early. You may have lost the bone 20 years ago. when you were drinking. I don't know, and I can't tell you, but if your parathyroid's fine, just plain hypogonadism doesn't usually cause that level of osteoporosis.
I have osteopenia in my hips. The osteoporosis is actually like L1, L2, where it's that negative 4.2, and then the...
Right. Okay, well, good luck to you.
Well, thanks a lot, Doctor.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate your help. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I want to answer a quick email from Lenore in Watsonville. Lenore says, I might have contracted the swine flu in Guadalajara last February. We were there the first 9 days of February. The first night in Manzanillo, I felt sick, and around 1 a.m., it came out both ends very fast. She describes a very classic flu with severe onsets, everything hurting, hairs hurt, fingernail hurts. She made it through, and her question is, would it contribute to the epidemiology of this outbreak for me to be tested for antibodies to this new strain of H1N1? And answer, Lenore, given that you got sick the first night you were there, and this outbreak really hit the ground in sometime in March in Mexico, I think the timing is wrong for you to have had the H1N1. If you got sick on day 3 in March, I would think it possible, and I would urge you to get blood tested. By now, a nasal swab will be negative, and it would have to be serological testing. But I think you had the regular flu picked up in the United States, and it was incubating when you got on the airplane, just based on the timing. Let's go now to Sarah in Santa Cruz. Hello, Sarah, and welcome to the program.
Thank you, and thank you for all the work that you do for the community.
You're welcome.
I have Hashimoto's disease.
Mm-hmm.
It was diagnosed when I was about 25. And I've been taking different forms of thyroid supplement for all those years. And I've stayed at exactly the same level for 25 years, at 137 or 138.
138 is the dose?
The dose that I take, right, exactly. And I've had the tests once a year almost.
Yes.
So and pretty thorough. But I have reactions to the medication. And at first, when I was in it, and I noticed it like the next day after taking it originally, and then I noticed it almost every time the dose was changed since I've been on levothyroxine.
Mm-hmm.
When I was on Synthroid, they thought that maybe it was the binders.
What's the nature of the reaction?
Okay, so the nature of the reaction possibly stems from another issue, but the nature of the reaction is that I have intestinal spasming in my splenic plexure.
Okay.
I have an intense nausea.
And you get this every time the dose is changed, but not necessarily once you've been on a single dose for a while, it goes away?
It doesn't go away. And so it seems to me, and so I've actually gone to a compounding pharmacy who has been very sensitive to trying to figure out if there's something in the binder. We're talking about over years of trying to figure out why, you know, sometimes I could, for 3 months, be perfectly fine, and then...
Okay, now wait a minute.
Okay.
This is the only drug you take?
You know, that was another question I have. It is the only drug I take, but I take vitamins, and I take other things, and it just occurred to me...
Yeah.
That I might be allergic to the binders in the vitamins or something else that I'm taking. However, this seems to change on the day after I take a new dose of the thyroid, not when I add another drug.
So even if you've been completely fine and you're in one of your periods of remission, you get these periods where you don't have the pain, right?
Yes.
Okay, so you'll be in the middle of 3 months of doing well. You'll change the thyroid dose in response to having a change in your TSH. So the
No. Literally, I order it from the drugstore. He gets a new amount of thyroid, and he orders it in 100 capsules. And so it's 100 days of that same amount of the medication that I get. And then when he orders it again, that's when I have... I have been on the same dose for all these 25 years. It's that every time it's ordered, it's a different batch, is what I'm beginning to understand, of the levothyroxine.
Okay. This is far-fetched.
It is okay.
It is far-fetched.
Okay, so levothyroxine...
I think we need to look for other possibilities here.
Okay.
Especially since it's an intermittent problem, and it seems like I'm hearing it comes and goes. And
but it comes and goes when I get a new batch of...
That's, you believe this now. And so now it will happen that way, even okay. if it isn't causal from the standpoint of there's something in the pill. There's this thing in your body besides your intestine called a brain.
Right.
And if you expect it to happen, it's very likely that you will trigger it.
Okay.
You could be triggering it. I don't know that, but I'm just saying I'm having a real hard time with the mechanism of this.
Okay.
And I can think of a really good mechanism, which is that you have a conditioned response now.
Okay.
You know, like the dog hears the bell and right. salivates kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not to offend you. I really mm-hmm. just, maybe there's a conditioning aspect to it. Simple thing to do is go to the brand name product. Mm-hmm. When you buy generic, the company that you're buying the generic from, which is usually a drugstore, will source that generic from different companies. And mm-hmm. so there would be some variability there.
Okay.
But if you are buying the product that is, you know, the name brand product, that doesn't change in terms of the dye and the excipients and the binders and the various other things.
Okay.
So it should be static. That would test the hypothesis. Because if you're still getting it every time you refill a new 100, that's very suspicious.
Okay.
You might want to buy it in 30s and see if you get a flare every month when you do 30s. You break it up a little bit. Test the idea that it's causal, because I'm not sure it is.
Okay.
Looking at binders and excipients and things, those are pretty common. And so they would be in vitamins, they would be in supplements. Aside from the Synthroid, the stuff that they put in pills to make them into pills or capsules is a fairly short, maybe 10 different compounds. So you'll have encountered those compounds when you've taken other things, even like over-the-counter painkillers or decongestants or things like that.
Okay.
And if you aren't seeing the flare then, you know, you aren't seeing, oh my God, that triggered me. That really makes me doubt that it's some kind of ingredient in the Synthroid or in the levothyroxine, rather.
Okay. But the levothyroxine itself being ordered from different companies would only be that particular chemical, and that hasn't seemed to...
I really think you need to look at other possibilities here. It sounds to me like you might have a spastic colon or irritable bowel disease. There may be some food allergies. You know, food allergy testing might be a reasonable thing to look into.
Okay.
And see if there's something that's driving this. Because what you're describing is, in terms of the cognitive model, the hypothesis that you're presenting to me, I'm like, you know, I'm skeptical. I think I want to look at other possible things, and obviously I want to try to help with your symptoms. So I would look maybe going on an elimination diet, taking out the major food antigens that are in our food, you know, going on a very clean, minimalist diet for a cycle, maybe a month, and see if that alters the way your gut function.
Okay. And are there any supplements to either calm the gut?
That's a big topic, and not one we have time for today.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Someone else suggested doing a blind study. Get a new batch before running out of the old batch and have someone else set up daily pills so she doesn't know the day that the new batch has started. That's an excellent idea. That would help test the idea that this is an expectation-driven phenomenon. That's a very good idea. Thank you for that. Got another email here. Let me read this one from Karen in Battle Creek, Michigan. Red spots on the stomach. Dear Dr. Don, I'm trying as best I can to make it to old age. At 56, I'm in good health, exercise a lot, biked 127 miles just today. Wow, yes, you do exercise a lot, Karen. Questions. I have red spots on my chest, under my breasts, but above my belly button. Look like little red freckles, about a dozen. Seem to be getting more, but have not charted their location, have not been concerned, no pain. No itch, very red, kind of pretty, actually. Any ideas? And yes, Karen, I do have an idea. I think what those are angiomata. These are little red dots, cherry red, slightly domed, so they have a texture. You can feel them if you feel for them. And these are dilated blood vessels. They're hereditary. They are associated with sun exposure, but they typically occur on the torso. They are nothing to worry about. And I expect that your father or mother had quite a few of them. That's generally the case in these. Another thing that Karen said, my 16-year-old daughter is thinking of becoming a doctor. I hear your request for primary care doctors, and I'm pushing her. She's perfect, yet, as you know, a thankless job, a calling. I know she will have a rough time, but we must raise our children to give back as you do. Thank you, Karen. Thanks for encouraging your daughter to go into primary care. I have a great idea. Let's pay for the medical education of people who sign a contract that they'll go into primary care. That will buy us a lot of primary care doctors in 7 years, and we're going to need a lot of primary care doctors. So we need to completely flip the ratio of primary care to specialists. We have more specialists than primary cares in this country. That's absurd. Any other country in the world will tell you you need about 80% primary care and 20% specialists if you're going to run your healthcare system efficiently. But hey, we've got the free market running our healthcare system, and I do put free market in quotes. It isn't working very well, and it's working less well every day. So just a little thought about healthcare reform. There's a lot going on this week. The health insurance companies are testifying before Congress and negotiating what the bill's going to look like. The Senate Finance Committee heard from Karen Ignacci, or Ignani maybe, president of America's Health Insurance Plans. Well, you know, they are in a bad bargaining position, the health insurance plans, because the proverbial 10-ton gorilla, that is to say the U.S. federal government, has decided it's going to do something about their industry. They don't have a lot of cards. They're basically now promising that they'll stop discriminating against women and charging them more for health care if only the government won't have a government-sponsored health plan that competes with them. Because we like a free market as long as that means we're free, but we don't like a free market when it means that people are free to go to the competition. And in fact, they're very worried about people deserting the health plans and heading for a government plan, a sort of government Medicare for all kind of plan. Women right now, if they're buying health insurance on their own, pay about 9% more on the average with different health plans. And that was one of the stories of this week. If you're sick, if you've ever been sick, if you have allergies, if you have high blood pressure, if you're over 50 years old and you don't work for a big company, or you recently lost your job with a big company in the economic downturn, you're kind of out of luck right now with health insurance because you won't be able to afford it. If they'll give it to you, and they can charge you an ungodly high premium because you take allergy medications or because you have high blood pressure. I hear the story every day. It's ridiculous, and we need to fix it. Two features that have to happen with health reform, in my opinion, are there has to be a mandate. Everybody has to have health insurance. And if you don't have a lot of money, there has to be a government-subsidized option for you. And as long as we get those two things, I'll settle for letting the health insurance companies stay in business. I won't insist on single payer, although I do think that would be a better solution in some ways. It has its pitfalls as well. Let's just say mandate, government option, mandate, government option. And if we all focus on those two things, and if Congress focuses on those two things, we'll get a significant improvement in the current state of affairs. And at this point, we really need a significant improvement. Let's talk to Maria Elena in Salinas. Hello, Maria Elena. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine. How are you doing?
Doing good.
My brother, who's about 56, and my mother, who's 93, have both been diagnosed with macular degeneration.
This is your mother and your brother?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
So I am wondering if there's anything that they can do to slow the progress of it, or if they just sit around and wait.
Oh, yes, there are definitely things that can be done to slow the process of it. There are a number of agents that are currently being used in people with macular degeneration. There are two types of macular degeneration, I should say, a wet and a dry, and they behave differently. The wet is the more dangerous one because you can get rapid shifts in vision, and there's actually fluid leaking behind the retina in the macula. So you can imagine if your windshield is wet, you know, you're trying to look through a film of water, you don't see through that very well. And it's because it's water, it can come and go. And so the fluctuations of the vision make it really hard for people because you can't adapt. We're capable of adapting to a lot, but constantly having it change really creates a very disabling condition. One thing that I want to point out is that you are at risk for this because there are hereditary components to this disease, and you should be on, there's a particular formulation of vitamins that's been scientifically shown to protect against macular degeneration. There are several brand names. Lutein, L-U-T-E-I-N, is one of the components in this vitamin formula. One brand name that I know of is called Ocuvite, O-C-U-V-I-T-E, but there are many others. The formula is published, and so you can find many vitamins now. Since this is not proprietary information, it's spread very rapidly, and there's lots of competing products. The gist is a diet high in fruits and vegetables and antioxidants is in your future. Okay. And getting an Amsler grid, which is a little square grid that will help show if you start to develop macular degeneration. You can get this from your eye doctor, and you just test yourself every morning. You hold it up, close one eye, close the other eye. And if the grid shifts or starts to bend, then that means that you've got swelling in the macular area and you want to get to a doctor right away.
Okay.
For your brother and your mother who already have the disease, the vitamins are helpful in slowing the progression. So they need to get on those if they haven't already been prescribed.
Okay. So that's the wet kind. And the dry kind, same kind of thing?
The dry kind is also helped by the vitamins.
Okay. They are pre-diabetic, and I don't know if that makes a difference to what kind it is.
I don't either. It probably does, but I don't know the answer.
Okay.
You know, pre-diabetes, definitely diabetes puts a strain on the retina. High blood sugar causes a deposition of a compound in the blood vessels of the retina, and then the retina becomes starved of oxygen, and the damaged blood vessels eventually can bleed. It's a it's a process, and that's why control of blood sugar is so key.
Okay.
If they're pre-diabetic, based on your name, I'm wondering if you have Latino ancestry?
My uncle definitely was, two uncles were diabetic.
Mm-hmm.
And an aunt, yeah.
Right. And there's a strong hereditary component to type 2 diabetes. So what I was saying about the diet high in fruit and vegetables... People who carry this genetics need to really watch their consumption of starch and sugar.
All right.
And unfortunately, the traditional Latino diet has a lot of... It isn't actually the traditional diet of the poor people. They were living on beans and rice. But the sort of modern diet with lots of tortillas and a fair amount of carbohydrates coming in from various sources, this really creates a setup with that DNA. And you need to really limit your simple carbohydrate consumption to about 150 calories per meal. And if you do
per meal.
Okay. Don't give your body more than 150 calories of sugar ever to process. And that will over the lifetime, that will tend to significantly reduce your risk of diabetes yourself.
Okay. Good.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Let's talk to Doug in Santa Cruz. Hello, Doug. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Good morning, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
Nice talking with you. I wanted to talk about health care in terms of prevention. I mean, prevention is the real key to health care, yeah?
Yes, I agree completely.
But what I seem to notice is that most of the people that aren't really aware of eating like things like fruits and vegetables and cutting down on their sugar and you know, getting enough vitamins and eating healthy and trying to get omega-3s rather than, you know, French fry fat.
Right.
Are people who are lower down on the food chain.
You mean on the economic food chain?
Yeah, as well as educational.
Okay.
People who maybe have a high school education. Myself, I have a couple of degrees, and I understand the things that you're talking about, but before I had my degrees, there's no way I would understand all of this technical talk sometimes that goes on in this world. And you know, how do we reach these people in terms of prevention, because it seems to me that they're the ones who need it the most.
Absolutely. I think we start in the schools because that's where we form our habits, is when we're young. And the mothers, women are very interested in keeping their babies healthy. So if we took the WIC program and we amplified, first of all, we need to radically revamp what WIC pays for, because WIC and food stamps in general don't encourage healthy habits. A lot of the dietary advice that's coming through WIC and through the food stamp program.
Yeah, if you go to your food banks, they give you, you know, white bread and white crackers.
Exactly.
Well, macaroni and cheese.
These are the wrong things for people to be eating. Once upon a time, have you ever read anything by Michael Pollan, P-O-L-L-A-N? He writes about food politics. He wrote Botany of the Desire.
I've seen his name on the web pages, Michael Pollan.
I'm trying to get him in as an interview because he has such a wonderful historical perspective on this. Back in the 1970s, once upon a time, there was this thing called the farm lobby. It's gone now. There is no farm lobby. There's agribusiness. And the agribusiness is what replaced the farm lobby.
Yeah.
But there were all these independent kind of grassroots, burly guys with tractors who had a lot of power because they had subsidies that dated back to the 30s, and they swung a lot of power in Congress. And in the 1970s, Nixon and the then Secretary of Agriculture decided to change the whole structure of things and got the farm lobby. And they did that in a very interesting way that's led to our current excess of corn and soybeans. They picked a couple crops and they guaranteed a price for them. So if you've got the choice between growing something that's subject to market fluctuations and where you might have a crop failure, or you plant something where even if your crop fails, you're guaranteed a price. It's a low price, admittedly, but it's so many dollars. It's $1.70 per bushel or something like that. And you
and
know
the Republicans in the 70s.
Yeah.
Gaining control.
Oh, they were also...
The Republicans are controlled. Please excuse me for being political here, but it's just an observation that I've had over the past
40
years.
They also eliminated hunger in America by making everyone fat.
They eliminated hunger, so they made everyone unhealthy.
Right, but, and now
instead
we have a short...
Instead of being lean and mean, we're all fat and la-la.
Well, hungry people are more difficult to manage politically than overfed couch potatoes, and so turning us into a nation of overfed couch potatoes has really made it easier to manage us, and so maybe it was some vast conspiracy. I think it was
1984-ish.
I think it was accidental good luck on their part. Good luck being in quotes. But anyway, back to how we do this. You start in the schools, and you start with the young moms, and we start by subsidizing for the food banks, for example. So we start there, and then we make healthy food available conveniently. You know, the vending machines have to be able to vend healthy food, or they aren't licensed. We need to get rid of sodas. And personally,
phosphoric acid.
I think we tax them. I think we tax them the way you tax booze. So instead of
or
cigarettes, instead of being a cheap drink.
Yeah, if it's an unhealthy item, then it gets taxed, just like any other unhealthy item.
Yeah, I think between those strategies, re-education, you know, mandating availability of healthy options.
And get some real doctors like yourself, diet doctors and nutritionalists, some real ones, not the fake ones that Bush puts into office to be yes man. You know, they're yes men.
Yes.
Like they nod their heads, whatever the president says, yes.
Well you know,
we need some real people who are actual nutritionists who know what the heck's going on so that they can mandate this program.
Well, you know, I think we've entered the age of big government with a vengeance because they're the only ones with the ability to print money. So it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. But that's a good argument in favor of single payer, is that if you have a single payer system, you have a closed loop ecologically in terms of money, money in, money out.
Yes.
What happens when you have single payer is you start paying serious attention to prevention because it suddenly matters. Right now we have a broken...
Because it's cost effective.
Yeah, we have a broken loop. If you get sick, you lose your job, you lose your health insurance, you can't get more health insurance. So the health insurance companies don't have to pay for your healthcare. And of course, when you get sick, you do lose your job. So there's kind of a catch-22 there. I'm going to go on to some other callers. Thank you for your input.
Oh, by the way, California is eliminating dental care for people now on the, what do they call it, the California program.
Right, exactly.
No more dental.
The dental benefit's been a bit of a joke, actually, although there are good places like Dientes where you can get subsidized dental care.
Yeah.
It's been a joke anyway because the payments were so low. No one was taking them. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. So let's talk to Nancy in Aptos.
Hi. I have actually two different questions.
Go ahead.
One of them is, I was wondering if you recommend Suboxone for OxyContin withdrawal versus, you know, going cold turkey and using supplements and alternative therapies.
Okay. Well, what kind of OxyContin habit are we looking at here?
Well, I'm not sure because it's my son, and I know he's smoking it. And I think he has to take it like every 5 or 6 hours.
Okay, so if
I think it's severe.
Yeah, if he's
so
starting,
the family's doing an intervention.
Right. Well, I think that methadone and Suboxone are essentially the same thing, except Suboxone's a pill.
Oh, okay.
And the idea is that it blunts the withdrawal symptoms, and it doesn't get you high, so
right.
you can taper it gradually and not go through an abrupt withdrawal. The advantages to an abrupt withdrawal are that it's very quick,
mm-hmm.
and there seems to be some evidence that going through a quick withdrawal and suffering
yeah.
may actually improve long-term outcome. In fact, there's another protocol that's coming out, which is even more radical than plain old withdrawal. They basically put you in the hospital and give you naloxone and block you completely. And so they dump you into withdrawal. Like
yeah.
one second you're fine, and the next second you're in florid withdrawal. And then they monitor you and give you fluids and supportive care. Perhaps it's the suffering involved,
mm-hmm.
but that seems to have pretty good long-term success rates with respect to people going back on drugs later on. And the problem with opiate addiction is relapse.
Yeah.
So I think that...
That's good info.
I think that going through a non-methadone, non-Suboxone program and maybe using ear acupuncture...
Yes, definitely.
Which is a very, very well-established protocol now
yeah.
in addiction medicine, might be the, sort of the medium level of suffering. But I do worry that the absence of suffering in the people who do Suboxone may actually contribute to relapse.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Because they don't learn, it's tough love, but
yes.
sometimes you got to learn a lesson.
I think my son needs tough love. I wanted to also ask you about IVIG therapy for neuropathy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know much about it at all. And my sister has severe neuropathy from Lyme disease,
mm-hmm.
actually from taking antibiotics for years.
Right. I don't actually know much about it either. How about if I look into it? Are you a regular listener?
Yes.
I'll try to come up with some commentary on it in the next couple of weeks.
Okay.
All right.
That'd be great.
I'm making a note of it. IVIG.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. We're going to go now to Ellen in Carmel.
Hi. I'm in my early 60s. I was recently diagnosed with Hashimoto's and have been on Synthroid for about a month, and a phenomenal response. Got rid of the brain fogginess and all the symptoms that I was having. I also, for about a year, have been on lovastatin, and after being on 20 milligrams for a while and being retested, my physician bumped it up to 40, and this was before the Hashimoto's was...
Discovered. Right.
Before the symptoms had come about. So I have read or heard, maybe I've heard, that there is some kind of an occurrence of high
cholesterol. Yes. Basically,
cholesterol.
When you have low thyroid function, your cholesterol goes up.
Okay.
So some or all of your need for the statin may evaporate now that you're receiving appropriate thyroid supplementation. What I would suggest is, once your thyroid dose has stabilized and you have a TSH in the range of 1 to 3, I would shoot for optimum TSH here, then I would stop the statin for 6 weeks.
Stop it completely?
Yes, and then retest.
Okay,
because,
that makes sense.
Yeah, think about this as well. The statin is a preventative agent, unless you've already had a stroke or a heart attack, and then it's secondary prevention. But it's primary prevention of a long latency disease that's going to take years to develop. So you're taking the statin so the cholesterol remains low so that you don't develop plaque.
Yeah.
Being off the statin for 6 weeks is not going to give you a heart attack or a stroke or allow significant amount of plaque to get rolling. Even if you do need the statin and your levels turn out still to be high, you're not going to cause any problem being off of it for 6 weeks.
Sure, and then maybe I would...
And maybe you discover
a lower dose.
Or none at all. It's quite possible that one of the things I do, if I see high cholesterol in someone who's young or it's unexpected, I always check the TSH to make sure that they don't have a thyroid issue. And perhaps everybody who has elevated cholesterol should have their thyroid checked. That isn't standard of care, but you could make the argument that it should be.
Yeah, and actually it had been tested a couple of times by my OBGYN, but nothing showed up until I got nodules that appeared, and then they tested those, and I went through the biopsies and scans and all that. So the blood levels weren't as indicative as the appearance and growth of nodules.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
But
well,
the symptoms were...
The symptoms were there.
Starting in January, the symptoms got really quite pronounced quite mm-hmm. rapidly, and that's when we discovered the nodules. I was mm-hmm. really tired, but I thought it was from last year's surgery, which was totally unrelated and mm-hmm. not...
Did you have any other questions?
No, actually, just the one thing about the leg pain at night, kind of cramping, and I was wondering if that potentially related to the lovastatin.
It's possible, but I think more likely it's from low magnesium levels, and so we don't get enough magnesium, most of us, without taking supplementation, and if you're cramping, the first thing I have anybody do is start taking magnesium, at least 200 milligrams at bedtime, and you might need 400.
Okay, and I'll check my... my multivitamin mineral and see what's in there.
Well, not that much.
Okay.
Okay, good
Thank
luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Suri in Carmel. Suri, we have just a few minutes, but I wanted to get to your call.
Hi. I have had a lot of x-rays throughout my life. As a child, I had eczemas and I was treated. We had a doctor who used x-rays. That was a long time ago.
Yes, the so-called therapeutic x-ray, yeah.
So now, this is the thing. I have avoided mammograms because I also had ulcers, and they used to x-ray. I used to have GI series on a regular basis. Well, bottom line is that I resist mammograms.
Mm-hmm.
I have them very rarely. I also have fibrocystic breasts.
Uh-huh. So what do you do about the lump in your breast, right?
The cyst. Yeah, fibrocystic breast in my...
I'll make some suggestions here. You could,
let me just tell you the final thing, though. I went to a doctor for a different reason yesterday for a blood clotting issue, and he just felt around under my arm, and he said I had something in the lymph gland. He said there was a lump in my...
Lymph node, right. I understand.
Yes, and that I should get a mammogram right away, and now that I'm really scared, of course, I... We'll probably do that, but what I wondered, is there any alternative to a mammogram?
Sure. The question is whether or not you have breast cancer, really.
Yes.
And so you could take out the lymph node in the armpit, and that would be a simple office surgery, and if it's got cancer in it, then you will need definitive surgery and probably a mammogram at that point, but it won't matter because that breast is going to be coming off, or part of it is anyway. You could just go for the lymph node first. It's not typical, but it's a perfectly rational approach. Every time you get a breast x-ray, you're exposing your breast to radiation. In a person who's had as much radiation and carries as many cancer lottery tickets as you do, one would seek to minimize radiation. Another alternative would be to get an MRI of the breast. That's a very effective way. You might have to ante up some money for it yourself because your insurance isn't going to want to pay for an MRI just because you're afraid of radiation and choose not to have it. Whether that's appropriate or not, that's the situation. So you'll have an uphill battle getting it covered. A thermogram will cost you a couple $100 and will give you a good indication of whether that is a cold nodule, is something that would be at risk for cancer, but unfortunately, I think fibrocystic breasts are going to show up on that mammogram. An ultrasound will show you cysts, but it doesn't definitively rule out cancer. So in your situation, I think the smart move would be to go after the lump in the armpit, which is the thing that has gotten everybody worried.
Mm-hmm.
And you could probably find a surgeon who would agree to do that. Just, you know, tell them you refuse radiation and you want the lymph node taken out, and they'll probably do it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We just have one more question.
Real quick, go ahead.
Yeah, TSH ultra-sensitive is 4.39.
Yes.
It's gone up because I was trying to take a lower dose. The free T4 is 1.36. Both of these are within the normal range, but it's not the ultimate.
Right, it's not optimal. So why are you trying to take a lower dose?
I guess just because I don't like to take medication, and I was hoping to gradually reduce it.
You know, I'm going to take the fifth on this because we don't have time to get into a discussion of how to taper yourself off of thyroid medication, and it isn't always possible.
Uh-huh.
So at this point, I think you might want to go back to your previous dose while you get this sorted out. And by the way, iodine is protective for the breast, so you might want to take extra iodine.
Gotta go.
Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks.
We've come to another hour. The finish of another hour. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This is Dr. Dawn Motika saying so long and stay healthy.